Hello, I'm Kate Fitzgerald from the Learning Hack team, welcoming you to the private view for Season 6 of Great Minds on Learning. In this highly acclaimed series, Professor Donald Clark, internationally famous author, blogger and entrepreneur, joins John Helmer to explore 2,500 years of thought and theorising about learning from the Greeks to the geeks. Ahead of the launch of this latest season of the podcast, John and Donald got together to give a sneak peek at the delights in store.
Welcome, everybody. Donald and I are about to embark on a brand new season of Great Minds on Learning. We have 5 seasons under our belt so far. But before we rush into talking about the future, we're very excited about the next season. Before we get into that, it's worth a quick pause maybe to look backwards at what we've done so far. Donald, what surprised you maybe about the seasons we've done so far and what the reaction's been like from your point of view?
Yeah, it's very interesting because this whole podcast thing, of course, as we know, came from nowhere. Nobody predicted 10 years ago that, you know, half the world would be listening to 1 and 2 hour long audio only experiences from their mobile phones or out walking the dog or in the gym or while they're washing the dishes or whatever. But that did happen. So I think what we did was we recognized that that was a great medium, especially for learning these very abstract, deep, you know, these are, I think it would be fair to describe, we do fairly deep dives into topics at quite a high theoretical level, calling upon the theory, being critical of the theory. And what has surprised me is how much people like it, actually. You know, when I'm out and about at conferences and whatever, I can't tell you how many people come up and mention the podcast, you know, because that's how they got to know me, because they hear my voice, they hear that I'm Scottish, they get to know you, John, they get to know us as people in a way that they don't in other medium like blogs, because we're speaking like, as we're speaking now, speak as real people. You can't help but be authentic in a podcast.
Yeah, that can be a bit disconcerting when people come up to me and start talking to me as if they know me very well, and, you know,
that's right.
And name checking the head of fact and stuff like that. Yeah. And I'm thinking, do I actually know this person, or are they just kind of seen us on the podcast? Because sometimes you can't quite tell.
But another thing that I think is interesting is when people do discuss the podcast in detail with me, they quite like the idea that there was this vacuum, which was learning theory and learning theories, because people are busy, you know, they have busy jobs and so on. They don't have time to read all the papers and the books and, you know, go down. But, you know, because I had been writing this stuff for many, many years, over 30 years, really, and blogs and so on, there was a body of knowledge we could call upon. And you don't have to read all the books. Other people can do it for you a little bit and then start to synthesize. So I think people were grateful that there was a filling out of learning theory and learning theorists, many of whom they hadn't heard of before. Some real surprises, people were saying, that they really enjoyed hearing about X, Y, or Z.
Yeah.
That's another observation. But another one, I think, is I've learned a lot by doing it. It makes you work hard doing one of these podcasts, as you know, John, because you really have to do the research. You can't sort of wing it. And secondly, I really enjoy them. You know, my work, by and large, is quite solitary, you know, whether it's writing books or, you know, preparing things and so on. And I really like the dialogue thing, you know? Like, we know each other, we've known each other forever and a day, we know each other well, we're very different. I think that helps enormously, that we've got a nice contrast thing going on. So you've got to enjoy it. How many have we done? 30-odd or something?
And we're just recorded the 31st.
Actually. Was that the 31st? So that's a lot of podcasts.
It is. Yeah, and coming back on that thing of the reaction, I find it is different between this podcast and the other one I do, you know, the Learning Hack, because I think people come up and say, yeah, Pouchy, you got that going, top 5% in the world, all the rest of it. But there is a kind of feeling at the back of that you're doing it for personal aggrandizement, which is fair enough. With Great Minds on Learning, I get the feeling that the gratitude that people have for it, it's more like you're administering a public utility. It's a bit of infrastructure. People are so grateful for it because it is, you know, this kind of knowledge of how learning works is part of the oil, to use a rather old-fashioned metaphor, on which the kind of learning machine runs. You know, people have to know this stuff. They have to know how to do it.
Yeah.
And that it isn't formally taught.
Nope.
Although bits of it are. You know, you can go to university and study psychology. You can go and study philosophy. You can study management and other little bits and pieces of it. But it's not a discipline as such. So I think people are very grateful for the fact that, you know, we're laying out the landscape for them there.
I think that's right. It's not like, I don't want to hold it other than thou about this, but I'm not a big fan of people lock content up on Substack and so on, although I can understand it because people have to be paid, you know, they have to make a living, as it were. But by doing this is free for people if they want to watch it, or they can do your Patreon type stuff. But I think it is a sort of like a public service, really, but only because we both really enjoy doing it. So why not? You know, we've not got some great sort of, you know, moral imperative behind us, but we just enjoy doing it, and hopefully if people like it, they like it. So that's what I've enjoyed about it. And the feedback has been fantastic from people, really.
Yeah, that's a good corrective comment. I was getting a bit above myself there, Donald, talking about public utility. So anyway, so the sixth season is about to commence on the 15th of April. Very excited about that. We just recorded the first one. There's always a question in my mind as we progressed to the third season and the fourth. I was starting to think, well, we're going to run out of theorists soon or topics, but that doesn't seem to be happening. We've still got ideas at least on the table for another two seasons. How do you feel about that?
Oh, yeah, it's an endless well. We've got 2,500, well, longer, in fact. One of the ones we're doing are the scribes, the Sumerian, Babylonian, Egyptian, the origin of schools and training and teaching. And that goes back, you know, 5,000 years. But there is an endless well here because, you know, new things are happening, and we'll be talking about one of the things we're going to be doing are the connectionists. Most of those names people will never have heard of, but it's a brand new area of psychology that's influenced by AI and Bayesian prediction and so on. That will be interesting, but that's new. There are plenty other areas we haven't tackled yet, so that we've written that have been written in blogs and so on. So
okay, so let's start looking forward to the next series. We kick off with leadership, which we've just recorded, so it's very fresh in our minds. So tell us about that.
I really like the leadership one because I think it's very contentious. You know, we went through a fair number of leadership theorists from, Burns and Drucker through to more critical people around leadership, Mitzberg, Kellerman and Jeffrey Pfeffer. But I think that was quite a juicy, feisty one, because all is not what it seems with leadership theory, if you really look at the serious work that's been done on it, the lack of evidence behind its efficacy and so on. So that maybe has more controversy, perhaps, than the other ones. But really, we just finished that, really enjoyed it.
Yeah, and I like a podcast where we can talk about Charles Manson and Dolly Parton, as well as other theorists as well.
Yeah, we had Machiavelli, we had Hitler, we had everybody in that one, John.
Yeah, Elon Musk. The gang's all here, Sam Altman. Okay, so moving on to that one. The next one's one I'm very excited about. Is we're calling it Scribes as a shorthand, but really it's about the invention of writing and what that did to learning, isn't it? Want to talk a bit about that?
Yeah. Well, people assume that everything started with the Greeks or something, you know, and that's far from the truth. The invention of writing was about 3,200 BC in only four places in the world. And we're going to focus on the real evidence when schools first emerged. So you have in Sumeria, you have in Babylonia, you have these entire little schools or libraries that were burnt down and baked all the clay tablets. And we have evidence of how they actually learned, what the teachers did, the exercises that the pupils did. It's the first example of teaching and learning using real technology, which was clay and cuneiform. I then go, then we, in that same episode, we will be covering the Egyptians again, 3,000. They invent a different form of writing, more half pictorial, half phonetic. And of course, we forgot, we couldn't interpret this until the 19th century. Champollion comes along. And this is really close to my heart because I go to Egypt almost every year and have since the late 80s. I've been there very, very often. I can actually read some hieroglyphics. I've been there so often I've actually managed to interpret some of the stuff in temples now. But there, we also have, they have a god of writing, Thoth. So writing was a God-given thing and a special class of scribes and scribal schools. So we'll describe how that's relevant to the whole teaching and learning thing. And there's also the invention of writing about 1200 BC in China. So we'll be looking at that really early stuff. Real people, you know, in Egypt, not only the gods, people like Thoth, but Tahotep, there are some Egyptian figures, Duaketi and so on, that will be, and Enya that we'll be covering as well. I think that would be something that will be new for people, since they probably don't realize that how much detail there is and how much we know about that scribal writing culture that emerged in those really big civilizations.
Something I'm interested in, I hope we can kind of bump into that personal session of mine, is the kind of handover to writing from an oral culture and yes. The work of Milman Parry and Homer studies and so on, which I think is absolutely fascinating. And I'm really hoping we can get onto that.
What's interesting there is, you know, we regard the Iliad and the Odyssey as famous books, but they were not books at all.
They were poems.
They were poems, and they have all the structure of poems. And I remember I shocked an academic once to give a talk at the Brighton Festival and I said, well, you know, I'm not too sure we should be teaching the Iliad. And maybe it's a good thing that young people come to those books through feature films, because that's an oral and visual telling of the story. Because the Iliad is actually an incredibly difficult book to read. And if you've ever tried it, it's torturous.
Yeah.
He was quite shocked by this suggestion that we don't teach it from the book. Yeah. But of course they were oral phenomenon, yeah.
Yeah, of course. I mean, you read it now. You get a translation of the Odyssey, which does actually read really well.
Yeah,
you kind of read a prose narrative, but of course, the origins of this, according to Parry, are that you would come to a local pub, local tavern, maybe, and then the rhapsode would turn up, and the audience would gather around, and he'd get out his two-stringed instrument or a lyre or whatever. I'm kind of mixing up ancient Greece and Yugoslavia.
Yes. Now.
And there would be this kind of oral recitation, which is not quite poetry, not quite singing, not quite, you know, anything that we would recognize on Spotify as music.
Yeah.
This person would roll out this whole kind of historical narrative for you, which they had memorized and was put together through blocks of, you know.
Yeah.
But Parry talks about that. Don't want to go into it too much now, but I just think that's a fascinating area. And that's
something that's really interesting there is that's exactly what we're doing, John, isn't it, in the podcasts?
Yeah.
Often, because a podcast is like you're sitting in the same room as the people who are chatting. It's like being in the pub sitting next to somebody in the town. It's got that informal style about it. And in a sense, we're doing oral stuff. We're doing voice, not text. In a sense, the podcast harks back to that tradition.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Moving on to the mention of orality perhaps brings us on to Freud and the psychoanalysts. You know, Freud thought it was either oral, anal, or genital. So
yeah.
I don't know what we're saying there. Psychoanalysts is excellent. I'm quite keen to do that because I was very entertained by entertained isn't probably the right word, by Janet Malcolm's book in the Freud Archive, which is about the whole kind of controversy over Freud, Fleiss, and the subsequent legacy and of Freud among the psychoanalysts.
Yeah,
and I'm really interested to kind of to get your take on that and to fill that out. And how that relates to learning.
Yeah, well, people might think it's a bit of a tenuous link, but far from it. The whole therapeutic attitude and underpinning of learning in L&D and even in schools and universities these days is massive. And a lot of it goes back to that Freudian tradition. So we'll be starting with Freud, of course, because almost nothing has survived of Freud, you know, his interpretation of dreams, humor. Mm-hmm. It's all gone, you know, it's all been demolished. But interestingly, London was, England really took it on in anger, and we'll be covering Anna Freud and Melanie Klein, who really took all that stuff and started to apply it to learning. and education in particular in London. And then Carl Rogers is the big figure here, of course, because he brings it into, he sort of translates it into coaching and mentoring. And we all know how big that is. So that's going to be a very, it's not, this is not a history lesson. This is about where this came from. Is it right? Is it wrong? How substantial is it? And what effect has it had? So that will be fascinating. Is psychoanalysis just elaborate storytelling, as some people would say, or is it, has it got the meat that those people claim it has?
I think the fact that it still has this kind of ambiguous or multi-biguous, if you like, if that's a word, kind of meanings in our culture, means that it's still alive as a preoccupation to a certain extent. I mean, the ideas are still with us and the controversy is still with us.
Yeah.
And talking of controversy, after that, we'll be moving on to the continental theorists.
Yeah.
Which sounds quite a dry title, but who are the people in there and what's this all about?
Yeah, well, I mean, there are many of them, but I've focused down. I mean, there are loads of other people you could go into that are relevant to learning. We'll do that in another podcast. But here we're going to go to almost the base theory around continental philosophy that did affect learning in some ways, and that's Heidegger, Foucault, Lyotard, and Derrida. So these are the four big names that people often call upon for critical pedagogy and so on. And these are figures I know well. I did a degree in philosophy and postgraduate work with some of those people. And this is a good example of, I doubt if many people in L&D have read Heidegger, but if you had to, somebody else could do it for you because it's torturous. And the same is true, to be honest, of Derrida is almost impossible.
Yeah. And I doubt if there are many people in L&D who have had lunch with Derrida. Which
yes, I have had lunch with Derrida.
We have to bring this up.
Yeah, we do. that's an unusual claim to fame. But that will be an interesting, because the big figure in there actually in terms of influence is actually Foucault. And again, I don't think many people have actually read the original books, which I had to and did when I was younger, when they were first coming out, to be honest, some of this stuff, certainly not Heidegger, but certainly Foucault and Derrida, they were around and alive and publishing when I was a student. And as I say, I went for lunch with Derrida. So I think that will be a very interesting and maybe a more sort of esoteric one, but we'll make it relevant.
Yes, I've always loved Foucault's idea of serial incarceration, that you go to school and you're basically incarcerated and then some other education institution maybe, and then you go to work and you're imprisoned.
Correct.
And I read them quite soon after I'd stopped being in a punk rock band, so those ideas resonated with me. We're all in prison.
Yes, of course, we had Derrida in Scritti Politti, I think, had Derrida in one of the...
Oh, yes. Yeah. Politics is prior to the vagaries of science. It's one of the more unusual pop lyrics, guys. Yeah. You don't get that from Taylor Swift, I can tell you.
You do not, do you, John?
Yeah. And so the next episode is actually going to be something unique that we've never done before. We're going to do a Q&A, and we've really very much enjoyed on the live appearances we've done, the Q&As. People standing up and, showing us that we actually have flesh and blood listeners, which is brilliant. So we're going to devote a complete episode to it. We're very reliant on people to send in their questions. So you can send these either to Donald or to me. We're both very active on social media, especially LinkedIn. We prefer that you send your questions for this episode in as direct messages rather than putting them in the public forum, because... if you do that, everyone piles in, you feel you have to make an answer, and we actually have the discussion in social media rather than within the podcast. So send them to us, either to Donald or to me. It doesn't really matter. We both bring them along. If you want to email me, it's john@learninghackpodcast.com. It's fairly easy to remember. And we really look forward to dealing with those. The next one is going to be the last in the season, and we're probably going to do this. I should say that there could be change to any of these up to now, because, it's the world we're living in, it's a world of change. The current plans are for our last episode to be, we're recording a live event in the Netherlands, and it will be about connectionists. You want to talk a bit about that, Donald?
Sure, yeah. So this... I'm really looking forward to this one because since late last year, I sort of took some time off and did a pile of reading, really. And one of the things I was really intrigued by was a new area of psychology. And this is fresh, you know, right off the press, as it were, because the artificial intelligence thing that has exploded, there have been a number of theorists in psychology. So the whole AI, generative AI, came from a number of people like Hebbs, and we've covered this before, Hebbs, Rumel Hart, some of these people, and even Geoffrey Hinton, who has a Nobel Prize in AI and actually invented generative AI through inventing back propagation, was actually a sort of cognitive psychologist. A lot of people don't realize this, that a lot of the stuff that inspired AI came from looking at the brain at the level of a neuron with Hebbs, but also general networks that came through with Pitts and McCulloch and so on. But we covered that. But this is a new, there's some new kids on the block here, or some not so new. And we call these the connectionists. These are not the connectivists, which is Siemens and Stephen Downs and so on. This is connectionists. In other words, in what way is psychology, or what we know about the brain and how learning works, what can we learn from AI? There's a sort of dialectic between the two, because it's starting to uncover some interesting things about how the brain is a Bayesian engine that projects forward. It doesn't just receive sensory perception. So we're going to cover, first of all, we're going to cover some old names there, and that's Hume, Parfit, and Strawson, who are three philosophers who talk about the self. What is the self? What is consciousness? Strawson is particularly critical of the storied self. In other words, he thinks we create loads of fictions about who we are. That's an interesting one. But the really interesting figures there are Daniel Dennett, who thinks that consciousness is a bit of a mirage, really. But these are people who believe in the computational theory of the mind. That's not that the mind is a digital computer and works like computers, but it does computations in some way that is largely still unknown. But we're starting to get to grips with the predictive Bayesian nature of it all. The brain is a predictive engine. And there we'll be looking at a really fascinating guy called Nick Chater, who wrote a brilliant book called The Flat Mind. And this has real practical consequences in learning, because he claims actually that most of what we teach is a waste of time because it's not how the brain works. The brain is much shallower than you think. So teaching it deep concepts like values and so on, or unconscious bias and so on, a complete waste of time. He's interesting. And then Carl Friston, from UCL, now in the US, he is a high-end mathematician, AI guy with a deep interest in neuroscience. He's really a neuroscientist by training and background, really fascinating English theorists. And then Andy Clark, who was at Sussex, I think he's at the University of Edinburgh now, who wrote a really good a book about how, again, the brain computational model is a predictive thing, and how that actually produces dreams, hallucinations, when you take drugs, even some forms of psychosis, are all because the brain is a seeking predictive engine and is constantly misfiring when it doesn't find something, hence schizophrenia, hence dreams, you know, that sort of ill-formed reaching out by the brain, but it doesn't have anything to latch onto. And all of this we're doing in the context of learning. In other words, what does this tell us about how we should be helping people learn?
Marvelous. Looking forward to all of that.
Yeah.
The brain as a prediction engine obviously has imperfections, as you mentioned. So there could be some change in what we're predicting for the rest of the series, but largely that's the shape of it. And we hope you like the sound of it. And we're interested in, you know, in sending in questions for the Q&A, what suggestions you might have for areas you'd like to see us cover and so on. So we'll be publishing episodes fortnightly, as usual, from the 15th of April onwards. Don't miss the first one on leadership. Mm-hmm. Make sure you're subscribed so you get the whole series. We're also on YouTube, and you can subscribe there as well to get that pushed to you. And get your questions into me or Donald as DMs, please. And thank you very much. Look forward to yakking at you for the rest of this season. And thank you very much for following us so far. I hope you continue to do so.
Great Minds on Learning comes from the Learning Hack team and is produced by John Helmer. The podcast is based on a series of blog posts written by Donald Clark, and we thank Donald for his kind collaboration in this project. If you'd like text summaries and transcripts for these podcasts, as well as ads-free listening, early access to episodes and more, why not join the Learning Hack Pack? For less than the price of a coffee, you can get all these benefits and help to sustain us into the future. Go to patreon.com/learninghack for a 7-day free trial. That's patreon.com/learninghack.